Today is March the 27th, Wednesday, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know and do you care how big tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at PCRadioShow.org. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, which is www.prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. World Backup Day is coming, March the 31st. World Backup Day is an annual event aimed at raising awareness about the importance of regularly backing up personal and professional data to prevent data loss. The day encourages individuals and businesses to take the pledge to secure their data by creating copies in different locations, ensuring that important information is protected against unforeseen events. Protecting your data with backups isn't just a technical formality. Given the virtually unavoidable risk of ransomware, malicious or accidental deletions, and countless other threats, it's absolutely crucial for retaining your critical information. You cannot protect it if you do not know what you have. A well-thought-out and tested data backup strategy is needed. On World Backup Day and every day, prioritize backup, disaster recovery, and continuity to ensure that your data remains safe. World Backup Day is an annual event observed on March the 31st to raise awareness about the importance of data backup and protection. The day encourages individuals and organizations to take proactive steps to safeguard their data and prevent the loss of important information due to hardware failure, cyber attacks, or other unforeseen events. The World Wide Web just turned 35 years. It's unclear whether Sir Tim Berners-Lee knew the magnitude of his authoring of the 1989 paper titled Information Management, a Proposal, but it was undoubtedly a transformative moment for humanity and has impacted society and business in profound ways. 35 years on from a mere proposal, we have interconnected systems all around the world that are powering large-scale analytics workloads, cloud-enabled quantum computing, and artificial intelligence agents that are integrated into software components like Microsoft's Copilot module. Although the web was first proposed with Berners-Lee's paper, the building blocks were in place for a few years beforehand by the U.S. Department of Defense when it decided to implement TCP/IP into its network. Thus, ARPANET was born. This eventually evolved into the model that becomes the web we use today. But it was a simple idea then, and pales into comparison compared with the intricately connected systems that govern every aspect of our lives. The amount of data, for example, on the Internet has exponentially surged, especially in the last few years. Considering what form the data takes is also key. With high-speed connections becoming more mainstream, the amount of video content has reportedly increased to the extent that it now represents 53.72% of all content online. Now, however, there are also rising concerns over how much of the Internet is real. A shocking amount of the content on the Internet is fake, according to scientists with Amazon Web Services in a recently published paper. More than half, 57.1% of all the sentences on the web have been translated into two or more other languages, suggesting AI tools like large language modules like LLMs were used to create and translate them. It reinforces findings by 404 Media, showing Google News is inadvertently promoting AI-generated content. If Sir Tim has anything to say about the future of the Internet, we might adopt a new protocol known as SOLID, spearheaded by his new company, Inrupt. It leans on Web 3.0 principles and the prioritization of user privacy. Whether or not this idea takes off, however, remains to be seen. The Justice Department announced a sweeping antitrust lawsuit against Apple, accusing the tech giant of engineering an illegal monopoly in smartphones that boxes out competitors and stifles innovation. The lawsuit filed in federal court in New Jersey alleges that Apple has monopoly power in the smartphone market and uses its control over the iPhone to engage in a broad, sustained, and illegal course of conduct. The lawsuit, which was also filed with 16 state attorney general, is the latest example of the Justice Department's approach to aggressive enforcement of federal antitrust law that officials says is aimed at ensuring a fair and competitive market, even as it has lost some significant anti-competition cases. The case is taking direct aim at the digital fortress that Apple, based in Cupertino, California, has assiduously built around the iPhone and other popular products such as the iPad, Mac, and Apple Watch to create what is often referred to as a walled garden, so its meticulously designed hardware and software can seamlessly flourish together while requiring consumers to do little more than turn devices on. Apple has defended the walled garden as an indispensable feature prized by consumers who want the best protection available for their personal information. It has described the barrier as a way for the iPhone to distinguish itself from devices running on Google's Android software, which isn't as restrictive and is licensed to a wide range of manufacturers. But antitrust regulators made it clear in their complaint that they see Apple's walled garden most as a weapon to ward off competition, creating market conditions that enable it to charge higher prices that have propelled its lofty profit margins while stifling innovation. Consumers should not have to pay higher prices because companies violate the antitrust laws, Attorney General Merrick Garland said in a statement. We allege that Apple has maintained monopoly power in the smartphone market not simply by staying ahead of competition on the merits, but by violating federal antitrust law. If left unchallenged, Apple will only continue to strengthen its smartphone monopoly. Now that the Justice Department is mounting a direct attack across its business, Apple stands to lose even more. The Justice Department is following up on other recent attempts to force Apple to change the way it runs the iPhone and other parts of its business. Apple also had to open up the iPhone to allow apps to be downloaded and installed from competing stores in Europe to comply with a new set of regulators called the Digital Markets Act, or DMA, earlier this month, but its approach is being pilloried by critics as little more than an end around the rules that will enable it to continue to muscle out real competition. European Union regulators already have vowed to crack down on Apple if it finds the company's tactics continue to thwart true consumer choice. Intel's new i9-14900KS will run faster in pre-built systems with delitting. Intel just pulled a fascinating move with pre-built PCs that turns our user advice on its head. Intel's latest desktop processor, the Core i9-14900KS, which is the 14th generation, is the record-breaking fastest processor in the world right now. However, if you wanted to actually run that fast, you're going to need to do some serious modification, and that's going to void your warranty. But what if you could modify a CPU to run faster without voiding the warranty? Well, Intel has just given a handful of selected PC manufacturers permission to do just that. Since the 14900KS is so powerful, it runs hot and guzzles power. So Intel has cut a special deal with PC building companies like MainGear, allowing them to partially dismantle the chip and apply a third-party cooling solution directly to the CPU die, all while retaining the original Intel warranty. This process is called delidding, that is D-E-L-I-D-D-I-N-G, by CPU overclocking enthusiasts. Basically, it involves carefully removing the slab of metal that sits atop the silicon to act as a heat spreader. Of course, that's called the lid, thus enabling you to affix your own cooling system. Normally, you won't see delidded chips in pre-built PCs, but with Intel's temporary new deal, manufacturers can create custom cooled systems that squeezes as much performance as possible from the i9-14900KS. Such PCs are already on sale. MainGear's flagship MG1 custom desktop can already be configured with a delidded 14900KS for an extra $200 over the regular chip, with MainGear promising increased performance and cooling for the modified CPU. Although Intel has historically allowed overclocking with external software, it's the first time Intel has permitted third-party companies to truly meddle with their processors like this, and with warranty support, no less. Delidding a chip comes with inherent risk to the hardware, so the deal Intel has cut likely includes the PC manufacturers shouldering at least some of the risk. Still, it's quite exciting to see. This could pave the way for delidded CPUs inside more pre-built desktop systems, thus boosting the speed and thermal performance of the PCs we can buy. Unfortunately for PC building enthusiasts, Intel's benevolence on the matter does not extend to individuals. Popular tech YouTubers bemoaned this in a recent video review of the 14900KS, remarking that it's something it's never seen before, but it doesn't count for normal consumers. However, it goes on to say that the process is pretty cool and that it's hoped that we might see Intel selling pre-delidded enthusiast chips in the future. Notepad in Windows 11 gets spell check feature. Microsoft continues to improve Notepad with useful features in Windows 11. Incorrect spelling will be a thing of the past in Notepad soon. Microsoft is bringing the spell check feature to its Notepad app on Windows 11, and testers can now access the new spell check support in Notepad, which will be available to all Windows 11 users later this year. Spell check in Notepad works much like it does in Microsoft Word or inside the Microsoft Edge browser. Misspelled words are automatically underlined in red, and you can fix mistakes with a right click to see suggestions for spellings. Microsoft has even added autocorrect, so mistakes are fixed as you continue typing. Spell check in Notepad will also support multiple languages, and you can ignore words in documents and add them to a dictionary. This feature is enabled by default for some file types, but is off by default in log files and other file types typically associated with coding. You can toggle this setting on and off globally or for certain file types in Notepad app settings or temporarily for the current file in the context menu. Spell check in Notepad is the latest feature addition in a long line of improvements to this built-in Windows 11 app. Microsoft announced in December of last year that it's adding a character count to Notepad soon, shortly after the software maker added a new autosave option that lets you close the app without a save prompt every time. Microsoft has also added a dock mode to Notepad, tabs, Copilot AI integration, and even a virtual fidget spinner. This looks very much like having a very basic Word application. The PC is evolving from personal computing to innovation enabler. We have entered a new era. Until recently, AI has largely been operating in the background, quietly automating processes and improving performance. Yet the unprecedented adoption curve of generative AI that we saw in 2023 represents a widespread change in how humans interact with technology. This fundamental shift will have a lasting impact on how we live and work. If AI is adopted to its full potential, a study of the economic potential of generative artificial intelligence estimated that the technology could add more than $4 trillion annually to the global economy over the next decade. These figures are in addition to the extra $11 trillion that non-generative AI and other forms of automation are forecast to contribute globally. When caution is justified, so is excitement, because with great change comes great opportunity. Most people have only interacted with generative AI through the web browsers and the cloud, which have intrinsic reliability, speed, and privacy challenges that accompany any online-only, open-access, and corporate-owned platforms. Put generative AI on the PC, though, and users can get all the benefits without the drawbacks. That is why AI is changing the role of the personal computer as dramatically and fundamentally as the Internet did, redefining what a PC is and does, because the AI PC will empower more people to become creators of technology rather than just consumers of it. Microsoft is working closely with their software partners to redesign PC architecture for an AI-enabled world that people will get to experience on new models as soon as this year. We are capitalizing on our engineering strengths to create powerful new machines optimized for running local AI models, which can still leverage the hybrid cloud as well as local inferencing to work offline. Local inferencing and data processing also means less latency and opportunities for stronger data privacy and security, as well as improved energy efficiency and lower cost of access. Enterprise-grade security and privacy will enable personalized generative AI solutions, turning your PC into an intelligent personal companion, one you can trust to keep your information safe while doing tasks for you, because on-device AI can access all the same specific emails, presentations, reports, and spreadsheets that you do. Meanwhile, the work to use AI for improving PC performance and functionality will continue to accelerate. Peripheral solutions, for example, have led the industry by integrating machine learning technology to improve the hybrid work experience, including everything from noise reduction and voice enhancements to AI-powered cameras that automatically optimize framing, focus, and lighting for better video calls. Advancing AI will make endpoint security ever more vital. AI PCs will enable greater privacy and data security by offering AI applications the ability to reduce the risk associated with moving data to the cloud. But since on-device AI will be trained with sensitive user data, endpoints will become a bigger and more valuable target for threat actors. It is therefore even more vital that organizations invest in advanced endpoint security. For example, new-to-market security offerings include protection against zero-day exploits and AI-powered social engineering attacks by containing risky activities and wrapping around applications containing sensitive data, creating virtual machines that are isolated from the PC operating system. New research is already demonstrating the positive effects of AI on knowledge worker productivity and quality across a range of tasks that make up people's daily work, from creativity and analytical thinking to writing proficiency and pervasiveness. Use of ChatGPT-4 significantly increased performance, boosting speed by over 25%, human-rated performance by over 40%, and task completion by over 12%. Now, imagine the possible use cases when your personal companion integrates your internal company and personalized working data while still helping you quickly analyze vast volumes of public information to combine the best and most relevant of both. Whether you're looking for customer insights, conducting financial assessments, or creating a presentation, everything can be done faster, more comprehensively and privately with the power of local AI and efficient real-time delivery. Just as AI is being used to improve hardware performance, leading software vendors are developing their applications to harness local AI processing capabilities too. Whether you use Adobe Premiere Pro for graphics, Audacity for audio editing, Microsoft Teams and Zoom for collaboration, or the Microsoft Office Suite for productivity, they could all work faster and provide more personalized support, thanks to local inferencing. Two-thirds or 63% of young creatives in the UK said they are embracing AI to assist in the creative processes in music making, adopting it as a tool to helping them come up with new ideas faster and expand their vocabulary to finish songs more quickly. Conversational, natural language AI combined with low-code development platforms will help anyone develop apps with minimal hand-coding and turn their ideas into new working solutions for their organization or for themselves. This new interface and local enterprise AI will enable anyone to talk to their PC and build an algorithm or web tool and then publish it as a service. We also foresee new roles and opportunities for data scientists and AI developers, as well as huge demand for machine learning as a service. Because every company will eventually have its own private and tailored generative AI model for employees to use securely, PCs will remain as the primary access point and on-ramp for this incredible new technology. We have never been as excited about the future of the personal computer and the power of AI to reinvent the PC as we know it. And of course, we are using this technology in our own work, leveraging the latest in generative AI and machine learning to drive our own perpetual digital transformation. In this new era, to fulfill the potential of AI to improve the way we work and live, organizations must focus on leveraging these new solutions to continually enhance the customer and employee experiences we offer. With the right ethical and strategic approach, this is a revolution that can benefit everyone. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and sometimes the home office. Ascension, I'm hoping I'm not butchering that, because it's clear that it's a foreign item, because there's one of those little weird marks over one of the letters. Anyways, Ascension says, how can I improve my home office ergonomics? This is something that impacts a lot of us. We don't really think about it, but all of the different things with ergonomics are what are going to make us a little bit more physically comfortable throughout our workday. I mean, I'm sitting in a chair right now, which I utilize this same chair for my 8 hours or more a day that I work for the company I work for. And this is going to be one of the first things I'm going to tell you, because the chairs that you get when you go into a good professional office, whether we're talking Herman Miller chairs or something like that, they are chairs that are durable, that are designed for a good level of comfort most of the time. The better the company, the better the chairs are going to be. The chair I'm sitting in is It's from Secret Labs. I love this chair, and I've talked about this before. They're not a sponsor or anything like that, but it gives you an idea. I got a very nice, expensive brand name chair, not a Herman Miller, but it's comfortable, and it is a chair that I'm going to sit in all day long. So I do need to make sure I adjust this chair properly. Even though it's a good, expensive chair, it's going to be comfortable for me to work in all day long. I need to make sure that my feet are flat on the floor with my knees at or a little bit below hip level. That's kind of the goal there. You want just a little bit of that forward tilt. You don't want to have the knees up too high. And along with this, we also want to make sure that we've positioned our monitors at a comfortable level as well. So the top of the screen or where you're looking should be at or slightly below eye level. It should be an arm's length away. I want you to think about reading a book. No, not where you put the book up so close that you've got to lean back a little bit when you shift the pages. I'm talking a proper length, and that is actually at arm's length. That is going to help you. That's going to help your eyes. And helping your eyes is going to be one of the better things that we're going to be dealing with. Our bodies break down over the years. You're probably aware of that, but the eyes are the most important thing because restoring some of that is going to be very difficult. So let's move into the eyes. I want you to have good lighting. Your workplace should be well lit. You should have every effort going through to reduce your eye strain. You preferably want some natural light. If you don't have natural light, one of the things that you can invest in is making sure you have the right light bulbs to give you that natural feel. One of the things I do in my office, I have tunable white light bulbs. They're smart bulbs, and they're over my head. And I can tune those colors to match the daylight color that comes in the morning. And I do that, and I make sure that it's comfortable for me to be in there. I want that light to make me feel like the sun's lasting just a little bit longer throughout the morning. And in the afternoon, when the sun is setting on the other side of the house, I still have some of that feel, that glow of the sunshine coming in. Now, we do need to take regular breaks. There's a 20-20-20 rule that has been preached a lot over the years for our eyeballs. Again, 20-20-20, every 20 minutes, look at something 20 feet away for 20 seconds. So I look out the window just for 20 seconds at the this can be more than 20 feet away. I look out at the trees on the other side of the street. I look out at cars going by. I look out at my neighbor's lawn, which somehow the grass is greener over on the other side of the street. That's a fun reference for some of you out there. But you want to do that on a regular basis. That relaxation of the eyes, that refocus, is going to keep your eyes exercised, and that's so very important. Lastly, I want to talk about making sure that you're not working with that, many companies, if you're dealing with home office, they've got a laptop. I don't want you working necessarily on the laptop. I want you utilizing, if you have a set location, use an external keyboard and an external mouse and an external monitor. The monitor, that's just a matter of you get to size up everything. And, you know, when you go remote in other places in the house for whatever reason, or you go out into the field, whatever, you've got the laptop. But otherwise, I want you to set up this like a standard desktop computer. The monitor, that's whatever. But the keyboard and mouse actually become the most important portion of this. The external keyboard and mouse, that's going to allow you to have a natural hand position. It's going to reduce a lot of your strain. It's going to allow you to type faster. You're going to be more efficient with that external keyboard. And I'm not talking about one of these $5, $7, $10 keyboards. If you have the budget, start looking at something in the $50 to $70 range and move up from there until you find that keyboard, that holy grail of keyboards. And your mouse, again, make sure you get a nice one, the one that really fits your hand well. Go to a store that allows you to experiment with them, try them out, and find the keyboard and mouse combination that works for you. Just a little bit of how I look at ergonomics. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Many of us, when we buy a laptop, we treat it as if it was a desktop computer, and it's always plugged in. Is your laptop always plugged in whenever it is in use? Somewhere down the line, many of us got the idea that our laptops should always be plugged in to improve their performance. This is a myth that's slowly killing your laptop. Once your laptop is charged, you need to unplug it, or you might be tethered to the wall forever. Many laptops sit on a charger throughout the workday and through the night. We don't even think about it. We just plug it in everywhere. We're charging at work, at home, at the coffee shop, a collective addiction to a laptop at 100% battery. There's nothing more frustrating than a laptop that can't hold a charge, but your charging addiction may be accelerating the issue. Keeping your battery at 100% all the time is the worst thing you could do for your computer. According to Kent Griffin, assistant professor at the University of California, San Diego, he researches battery degradation and says this fully charged state puts a ton of stress on your laptop. When your laptop battery is sitting in this worst condition, that is 100% charge, for weeks or months at a time, that can be pretty damaging to it. So when you take it off and expect it to last 8 to 10 hours, it might only give you half of what you expect because it degraded a lot during that time. The optimal state for your battery, according to Griffith, is somewhere between 20 and 80%. He recommends charging your laptop fully and then unplugging it to run down throughout the day. You should let your battery sit in this mid-range zone for most of its life to prolong your battery's performance. The reason a laptop is under a lot of stress at 100% is due to its lithium-ion battery. It consists of two layers, one made of graphite and the other made of lithium cobalt oxide, with lithium ions passing between them. A fully charged battery looks like mostly all of the lithium ions in the graphite layer, releasing energy to your computer when passed into the lithium cobalt oxide layer. It's when there are too many lithium ions on one side that the battery gets stressed. It performs at its best when there's roughly an equal number of lithium ions passing throughout the battery. Griffith also notes that high-speed charging cables can ruin the integrity of your battery by transferring these lithium ions too quickly. You don't need to look much further than your desk to understand where this myth comes from. So many of us have come to believe that our laptops should always be plugged in. And that's probably due to your computer's predecessor, the Mac, the PC, and all desktop computers before the laptop had been permanently plugged in. This is flawed logic. Your laptop is not drawing energy from the wall outlet, like your desktop computer. Rather, it's drawing energy from your battery. Meanwhile, your battery is kept in this high-stress state, doing lots of little recharges between 99% and 100%. Another reason folks may be perma-charging is so their computer never dies, and I hear you, even though letting your laptop battery drain out and charge back up is healthier for your battery. It's not as convenient. With a permanently plugged-in laptop, you can always jump on the go with a fully charged battery. But over the long term, this doesn't work as well. For an older laptop that's been perma-charging, you may have a fully charged battery, but that fully charged battery won't get you as far. The newest M3 MacBooks from Apple tout an 18-hour battery life, but poor charging practices over the years could cut that in half. Permanently charging your laptop is not a way to optimize performance. It's actually quite the opposite. Nevertheless, laptops are plugged in constantly. The reason laptops permacharging is pervasive is twofold. For one, it feels like it should be true. You want to get the most out of your computer, so giving it a direct line to a power source seems like the best way to get power. But that's not really what's going on. The other reason is that most people are really using their computers away from the desk. It's just easier to not think about it and keep your laptop plugged in, always, much like you would a desktop. The problem starts when you leave your desk. You head on a trip, on the train, to a coffee shop sparsely populated with outlets. Suddenly, your weak battery is the most noticeable feature of your laptop. There's much more discussion about battery life around smartphones, but I argue this is less of an issue due to their optimized charging features. iPhones will learn your charging patterns, slowing down charging speed overnight so your phone spends minimal time at 100%. This feature is incredibly helpful for smartphone users who typically just charge their phones when they're asleep. New Windows and Apple laptops have these same optimization features, but they're still not a perfect solution if your laptop is charging 24/7. The optimizers just slow down your battery's charge to 100%. It doesn't help you once it gets there. A good solution is just plugging in your laptop overnight with optimized battery charging, but remember, you gotta unplug it throughout the day. So the responsibility to care for your battery falls on you. Lithium batteries will naturally degrade over time, but you can do a lot to get more life out of your computer. Stop charging your laptop past 100% today so you can free yourself from being plugged in tomorrow. The SIM card is going away. SIM cards are the tiny plastic circuit boards inside cell phones that contain the phone number. The days of the physical SIM card are numbered. Phone makers, led by Apple and the wireless carriers, are making the move to embedded SIMs or eSIMs, which are essentially digital cards that let you activate a new phone number through a carrier either locally or internationally. Newer iPhones sold in the United States don't support physical SIM cards at all. Google is now prompting Pixel owners to move their phone numbers to eSIMs, and Samsung's latest flagship phones often default to eSIM when you buy your handset from your carrier. Embedded SIM makes your life easier for international travel and switching phone numbers, among other benefits. But they can also be frustrating to use. SIM cards, which have been around since the 1990s, were once the size of credit cards, but are now the size of a pinky nail. The gold contacts that occupy one entire side of the especially small nano SIMs allow your phone to talk to the embedded chip, which contains your subscriber ID. An eSIM does the same job, but you can't remove it from your phone. As your contact list lives in the cloud, today, SIM cards serve only to store your account information, and that's a minuscule amount of data, small enough to be downloaded to an eSIM. Traveling is simpler, because you can activate multiple numbers on the same phone. In the past, only those phones with room for two SIM cards could have multiple phone numbers. Such devices were rare in the United States, but eSIMs have now changed things because they're fully programmable. For instance, current iPhones support 8 stored eSIM phone numbers and 2 active ones. So if you're traveling, you can simply download a new SIM to your phone, and if you change carriers or just want to change your number, you can also do that as many times as you want. If you have multiple numbers or travel frequently, an eSIM should make your life a lot easier. An eSIM can make it harder for attackers to steal your phone number. For many people, their phone number have increasingly become a key identifier as a way to receive two-factor login codes and password reset links. If your phone is lost or stolen, the ease with which a person can remove its physical SIM card becomes a security issue. Once someone moves that card to another phone, they own your phone number for all intents and purposes. A fraudster with control of your phone number can do a lot of damage in a short time. And as for your phone without a SIM card, tracking it or remotely resetting it becomes difficult. With an eSIM, in contrast, there's no card to take, so your phone number is subject to fewer risks. And if your phone is locked with a password, no one has any way to transfer that SIM to another device. If you break your phone, the eSIM is also toast. That means you can't transfer it to a new device. With traditional SIM cards, you can simply remove the card from your broken phone. You can then plug the card into another phone and be up and running in mere moments. And you'll never have to sit and hold for assistance while you do it. With an eSIM, you'll probably have to talk to your carrier about your busted phone. Carriers have more control over eSIMs. Using a nano SIM works the same way on every phone. Pull the card out and slot it into a different phone. The process for downloading an eSIM is anything but universal. For example, buying a new phone from your carrier should make the eSIM transfer seamless and instant. But if you buy an unlocked phone or you just want to use a different device that you already own, you may have to sit on hold with your provider or deal with other inconveniences. Downloading a new eSIM is still hit and miss. If the built-in download menu fails, you're at your carrier's mercy. Apple and iPhones is the closest to standardizing the use of eSIMs. When you buy a new phone, if your phone number isn't automatically transferred during setup, you can go to the cellular setting to download it manually. All major U.S. carriers support this process. Some Android phones, such as the Google Pixel models, include a transfer tool, but it often gives people error messages telling them to contact their carrier. For Verizon and T-Mobile Android phones, you may have to call customer service on a different phone, of course, and read off a 15-digit phone identifier. Meanwhile, AT&T has a self-service website where you can log in with a PC and scan a QR code with a phone to download your eSIM. If you don't have another phone or a PC handy, you might not be able to move your eSIM phone number. eSIM can't stop phone number theft at the carrier level. Keeping your phone number on a non-removable eSIM is helpful should you lose your phone, but that isn't how most people get scammed. The most common way criminals compromise phone numbers is with simjacking. That's when the attacker convinces or pays a carrier employee to transfer your phone number to a device that they control. Moving to eSIM doesn't prevent this tactic. Your carrier needs to enact and enforce good security practices, and carriers sometimes miss the mark by giving outsourced customer service too much control over your account and not requiring a PIN or password for SIM changes. Even if you prefer to use a physical SIM card, that may not be an option the next time you buy a phone. Apple doesn't sell any current-gen iPhones in the United States with a SIM slot, and it's only a matter of time before the same happens to Android. Transfers and activations still run into some inconsistencies on Android. But Google has started rolling out a more functional eSIM transfer tool that should work even with phones from different manufacturers. The pain points will decrease as eSIM becomes the default way that everyone manages their phone number. eSIM offer real benefits, too. It just might be a little annoying when you first make the switch, and you won't have a choice. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now, and Marty, I wanted to get your take on this. I wanted to kind of understand where you're coming from. All of this stuff in regards to artificial intelligence, and it's going to take over all of our jobs tomorrow, and it's going to put us all, it's going to destroy the world as we know it. All of that, blah, blah, blah.
For thousands,
can you tell where my world is, where I think it is?
Yeah, well, look, for thousands of years, we've had a lot of artificial intelligence in the workplace. It was just human.
Yeah, yeah. We've got people, artificial intelligence in Washington, D.C., too. But
yeah, yeah. It's people who pretended to be smarter than they were, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of tricks for that. And why is it any different when you go to programming? Programmers can make something seem to smart. In fact, go back to the magic eight ball.
All it's signs not a point to
model, but you know, yeah. It's, well, look, tons of money. Money is the reason for the AI boom. Everybody thinks they're going to invest and make it. Everybody thinks they're going to announce something and make it. Hordes of companies.
They're going to come up with a killer app. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Chasing the gold rush. Hordes of end users. Well, I can't exactly speak for them, but many of them seem to see it as a crutch to fill in the blanks when they're less than fully confident in some skill set.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, some see it as a contemporary parallel to cheating on their homework.
Yes.
Yeah, and some just like the glitz and cool of something that sounds like it should be glitzy and cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I say that AI is still 10 miles short of ready.
Okay, yeah.
All right, here's the math behind that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple. You've all heard it before. A miss is as good as a mile.
Yeah.
So 10 miles mean 10 misses. And here are 10 misses that you may want to consider.
All right.
Misapplication.
Mm-hmm.
Mischief. Misdiagnosis.
Huh?
Misinformation.
Oh, my.
Misinterpretation.
What?
Misrepresentation.
This is Marty Winston. My name is Benjamin. No, whatever. Yes, go on.
Misstatement.
Yes.
Mistakes.
Yeah.
Misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And misuse.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
This isn't a church sermon. I'm not going to explain each one because they all loop back to the fact that AI is created by people, not gods.
Yeah.
Yeah. People make mistakes. Don't always analyze consequences.
Sure.
May not be aware of the ways in which their software may be ignorant of nuances or alternate contexts. And they have as hard a time as anybody figuring out what information sources contain truths, lies, blather, and accidental or deliberate errors.
Yeah, and we've been seeing a lot of that. We've been, just as we go along, we keep seeing how, okay, this AI, after you leave it alone for an hour, it all of a sudden it says it has its plans to take over the world. or like you ask it something and it will tell you flat out, this is the truth. And you find out, oh, no, it isn't.
Well, what about the Russian intervention in our elections?
Okay.
That is a mix of AI and non-AI mimicry of what the AI is doing.
Sure. Malicious. The people putting stuff into the quote-unquote AI, various nuances, biases, and more that spin in whatever direction that the programmers want it to go in.
Indeed. Now, listen, folks, this is important.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that programmers are always going to get it right, if you think that no one will ever make a mistake, I'm going to bring in a notable personage from history. If you never, ever heard of Wrong Way Corrigan, look him up.
Okay.
He took off. He was a pilot. He took off from Brooklyn, New York on a flight to Long Beach, California. And on that flight, he landed in Ireland.
I had no idea. I mean, I've heard the reference Wrong Way Corrigan, but I hadn't realized. Okay. So how did he get that one wrong? Because like from New York to Long Beach, I'm very familiar with Long Beach Airport. I've flown into there many times. It's crossing a bunch of land, a lot of land. And Ireland is crossing a lot of not land, a lot of the Atlantic Ocean.
Right, but if you take off and it's cloudy or foggy or you're flying above that kind of thing, or if it's night, you know, you may not know that right away. Sure, you're going to hear more seagulls if you go toward Ireland.
Wow.
It's that kind of thing. Anyway, just for fun.
Yeah.
Let's go through those 10 misses that keep AI 10 miles away.
Okay.
in alphabetical order.
All right.
Misapplication.
Mm-hmm.
Mischief.
Mm-hmm.
Misdiagnosis. Misinformation. Misinterpretation. Misrepresentation. Misstatement. Mistakes. Misunderstanding. And misuse.
And those are all things that AI will give you, all kinds of different things that all of the different companies that own their supposed AI products are going to give you. This is,
It's flawed, and anybody who wants to find a flaw can. Why don't you go looking?
I've enjoyed using AI here and there, but I also use it with a very cautious, this isn't going to be quite right.
I love the way Microsoft's pushing theirs on you every time you go to Bing. And every time I try it, it disappoints me.
As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and the Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting Thursday, March the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is, What is an AI PC? Online virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. TED Ed Connect meets Thursday, April the 4th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, April the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. and it's an online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The King's Bight Computer Club meets Tuesday, April the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The phone number to call for more information is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.